from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. Always hate to disappoint, but I'm not Dave Graham. I'm Colin Mine, managing editor of VT Digger, filling in for Dave this morning. Hopefully he'll be back soon. I hope you enjoyed that final performance of summer over the weekend. It was absolutely spectacular, and the opening performance here of autumn. First guest this morning is Dave Van Dusen. He's the new president of Vermont's chapter of the AFL-CIO, the largest union in the state, I believe, all the unions together. The second half hour, we're going to talk to Central Vermont's Home Health and Hospice, who's kicking off a fundraiser for that fine organization, a longtime friend of WDEV. We're going to hear what they have to say about this fundraiser and what's going on with the organization. For the second hour of the Dave Graham Show, we're going to start talking to a climate scientist from Northern Vermont University, doing some really interesting stuff with their programs. They're integrating man-made climate change into their programs, their curriculum, and training the next generation of atmospheric and environmental scientists to grapple with this mess we've made. And the last segment is going to be with former Democratic gubernatorial candidate and electrical utility executive Christine Hallquist, talking about a cause that she's been speaking up about recently, which is the Free the Nipple campaign, and trying to decriminalize toplessness. But to kick things off here on the Dave Graham Show on Radio Vermont is Dave Van Dusen. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Colin.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. So maybe first you can tell us a bit about the AFL-CIO here in Vermont, who you guys represent,
sure.
And yeah, what's going on?
AFL-CIO is a federation of many different unions. We have about 10,000 combined members. We represent electrical workers, nurses, folks that do maintenance or custodial work in schools, writers, college professors, you name it, really across the board. But what makes us strong is that we come together in the Federation of the AFL-CIO, and we work together in solidarity towards common goals and to support each other.
And it's a national organization. All these different pieces in Vermont taken together are effectively the largest union in the state. Is that right?
Well, we have about 10,000 members. The NEA, I believe, has more members. They probably are up to around 14,000. But, of course, they're exclusively in the schools where we're really spread out across just about every sector in Vermont, public and private.
Good. So some live fact-checking of
me
right there. I appreciate it. So can you tell us a bit about your sort of history, both with the labor movement, how you got into it, and the AFL-CIO in particular?
Well, my story isn't that uncommon. My father was a union member, and he was an officer in his union, so it's a natural thing when I became of age to join a union and advocate for the same type of things that my father taught me as a kid. Previous to this, I was in the UAW, Local 1981. After that, I was a senior union representative with VSEA, representing largely AOT workers. And more recently, I've become a member of AFSCME Local 2413 out of the Northeast Kingdom. I live in Cabot. And that is my starting point concerning how I got to where I am now.
Interesting that you did some time with UAW. It's an interesting
yes.
time for them.
It, damn right it is. Solidarity with them all the way. I understand that GM made $8 billion in profit last year and paid essentially zero in federal taxes. And of course, they're saying they can't do right by their own workers. So God bless them, Godspeed, and 1,000% support for striking UAW members.
Yeah. So there was an election for the AFL-CIO recently here in Vermont. When was that, a couple weeks ago?
This will be just about a week and a day since that election took place.
And I heard it was a bit slightly tumultuous, something like that.
Well, democracy can be a beautiful and messy thing at times. We were very proud. And when I say we, I did not run as just me as an individual. We ran on a large slate called United, which included folks from all sorts of different unions, including the IBEW, including the UAW, and a number of other unions. And 14 out of the 15 seats on the executive board have now been captured by the United Slate. We're a progressive slate. We want to see changes within labor. We want to reevaluate the way we do things. We want to engage the rank and file more. And we were able to bring more union members and delegates to the convention last week than we have seen in two decades in AFL-CIO conventions here in Vermont. So that's how we won. And that's how we're going to continue to win. It's going to be through rank and file engagement. It's going to be through no more backroom dealing as something to rely on for our political goals, but rather to help build a mass movement capable of improving the lives of regular working Vermonters.
I want to talk more about your sort of vision for the union and mm-hmm. how the AFL-CIO fits in the union movement, but I'm wondering if you can just talk a bit about what the sort of divisions are within the AFL-CIO and why, you know, you talk about bringing sort of the progressive mm-hmm. candidates in. I understand Jill Charbonneau, the outgoing president. I'm wondering, does she represent a different sort of faction of the union, or what is the sort of disagreement about?
We did not run to criticize those who came before us. We ran to respect those efforts that they made. But we see things a little bit differently. We want to try things anew. So there was some question internally of whether or not what we've been doing in the past is good enough. And it related to that is whether or not if we just do a little better job at doing the same things we've done, is that good enough? Our slate said, no, that's not good enough. We need to radically rethink our approach to politics. And this goes right into, you know, what's the vision for the future? It's hard to talk about one without the other. But one of the things we've immediately have begun to do as the new leadership is we are setting up a committee that is going to look at, over a period of time, over a month or so, they're going to look at our past successes and failures concerning politics, the State House, legislative efforts, and determine what we've done well and what we haven't done well. And we are going to really reevaluate how we approach the political process, what our relationships are to the various major political parties, and how we can be more effective in the future. I'm not going to sit here and say we have an absolute plan right now ready to go, because part of what we need to do is involve the rank and file, and part of that means reaching back down to the ranks to have these conversations. So we expect to have a more final determination of what sort of change we are going to see at our COPE convention in January at the start of the next legislative session. But I can say this with certainty, is the fact that last year with two-thirds either being progressive or Democrats in the House, the fact that we didn't even get a hearing on something so important as card check, which I'm happy to go more into later on, but not even a hearing, let alone a vote, when we made it very clear that this was our top priority last year in the State House, is a problem. Of course, previously the Democratic Party said, well, we need a veto-proof majority, right, for us to get things done. And then they got that, and they got that in part with our help. We've endorsed dozens and dozens and dozens of candidates for Democrats. We should have been very well situated to get something like card check, which costs the state nothing, and also to see livable wage and paid family medical leave go through. And, of course, neither of those went through. So that's a problem, and that is one of the reasons that is sparking a reevaluation of how we could better approach electoral politics.
Yeah, and it's worth noting some of the other unions have shown significant clout, particularly the NEA and the VSEA, who, you know, oftentimes the sort of leading items on their agenda become priority issues for some of the more liberal members of the House and Senate. And one more question before we move mm-hmm. on to the sort of bigger picture questions. But, you know, a number of people were not happy with how the election played out. I don't know the numbers exactly. You know, we've heard from a couple of people who are part of the convention. Are you worried that there's going to be any effort to sort of undo this election?
No, absolutely not. We had an overwhelming, our slate had an overwhelming number of the delegates present, period. Record number of delegates, and they were overwhelmingly with us. We also had an overwhelming, with those delegates, representation. Overwhelming is the wrong word, but we had a majority of the rank and file members represented by those delegates. So in no way, shape, and form. And I want to be very clear, we had our differences as a good political democratic process should have. We had our differences during the election season. But now that election is over, we are one. We are united. We are standing in solidarity with each other, and we look forward to working very closely with all of our affiliates.
You're listening to The Dave Graham Show on WDEV Radio Vermont. Our guest is Dave Van Dusen, the newly elected president of the AFL-CIO here in Vermont. If you'd like to join the conversation about the future of the labor movement, if you have any thoughts on, if you're an AFL-CIO member and you have any thoughts on the future of the union, or if you're just interested more generally, call in to 1-802-244-1777. That's three sevens at the end there, or toll free 1-877-291-8255. That's 1-877-291-TALK. Later in the show, we'll be talking about the climate strikes on Friday. We'll be talking about the Free the Nipple campaign. If you're interested in those topics, then hold on and give us a call in the second hour. Dave, so you talked about sort of a number of bigger picture issues and sort of the political philosophy that you bring to the AFL-CIO. It sounds like the debate is somewhat similar to what's going on with the Democratic Party on a national level right now, which is, perhaps the old guard was a bit more like the Joe Biden, that you make sort of, you try to improve upon the existing system, whereas you're bringing in an idea that's more that you have to bring in, as Elizabeth Warren would say, big structural changes. So I'm wondering if you could sort of outline what sort of structural changes you think need to be made to the AFL-CIO in order to be a more effective organization. Before we get to that question, on the line we have Rich from Starksboro.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I got a question about a previous president of AFL-CIO who is now, I guess, involved in the campaign for Right to Work, and I guess in the current jargon, it's called moved over to the dark side. Can you comment on that?
Sure.
Can you tell how that happened? Can
sure.
you mention that person's name if you think it's appropriate?
Sure. And, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
I'm not going to mention that person's name. We don't talk about that person's name anymore in the AFL-CIO, but they're a traitor. They have nothing to do with labor now. They never will have anything to do with labor, and they are now publicly talking against very core issues that are important to organized labor. So that previous president is in the past. It's unfortunate that they've chosen a very different side in their post-presidency life. And really, that's all I'd like to say about that. I'd like to focus on the future, not on the past.
Great. So I was asking about these sort of big changes that you think need to be made to be a more effective organization, stemming from some of the frustration of not having the sort of influence politically in particular that you'd like to see.
Okay. So internally, this will be the last election, if we're successful, this will be the last election that is done through delegates. The delegate system within the AFL-CIO is a lot like the Electoral College. In my opinion, in my slate's opinion, in United's opinion, that is undemocratic and is not the way we should be doing things in 2019. So what we are going to do is we're going to change the constitution of the Vermont AFL-CIO to give every single member a direct vote for the officer positions. That will be something that will happen over the course of the next year and a half. There's a process there, so it can't happen with a snap of a finger. So we are going to open up our internal processes. We've already, on our first meeting as a new executive board, voted to make every single one of our executive board meetings open to every single AFL-CIO member. We're going to do a better job communicating to the rank and file. We're going to ask more of them for their opinions and their outlook on things as we formulate policy. And we're going to internally transform the AFL-CIO into a much more democratic organization, one that is no longer rooted in the 1950s, but one rooted in the present. Externally, we want to do something similar with the democratic process in Vermont. As we see the problems in the State House, where elected officials sometimes do not represent the views of their constituents, or they get elected on a certain platform, and then yet we still don't have a $15 an hour livable wage. We intend to start a conversation statewide about changing our constitution to allow for a town meeting-based referendum system, whereby citizens themselves, and of course the working people, working class, is the great majority of Vermonters, can circumvent the State House or the issues, or the politics of the State House, and directly try to transform policy and law at the local level and on a statewide level. And we believe this would not only revive the town meeting system, but this would also give working people much stronger of a voice politically in the state of Vermont.
Dave, you and others who are on your progressive slate have, with the effectiveness of the union and actually getting some policy changes and that sort of thing. One thing you mentioned was the card check. I'm wondering if you can explain what that is exactly and what efforts were made last year to make it happen in the State House.
Well, good news is there's another winter, another legislative year, right? So last year, the bad news is last year we had... we had some folks introduce bills in the House and Senate that for public sector employees, if a majority of them sign a petition saying we want to join this union, then essentially they would be automatically recognized as a union. Presently, the VLRB process is very cumbersome.
The Labor Review Board.
Yeah, correct. Is very cumbersome and very time-consuming, very bureaucratic, very legalistic. And it provides certain built-in advantages for the employer to run anti-union campaigns while you're waiting for a more complex vote to occur. So this bill is very simple. Massachusetts has this in law. Many other states across the country have this in law. It says, no, when folks sign and they say they want to start a union, a majority do democratically, then they get to join a union, right? They get to be part of a union and they get to start bargaining for their next contract. It's very simple. Unfortunately, like I said, we couldn't get hearings on this bill last year. It literally would cost the state nothing. It's just a more fair way in the Trump era for us here in Vermont to help level the playing field a bit for organized labor. Now, of course, under Trump's Supreme Court, recently they outlawed agency fee or fair share, which is a form of dues that go to support the union. The only reason that that was ultimately ruled illegal, and they stacked the Supreme Court to make sure that that would be ruled bogusly illegal, is as a way to try to break or weaken the public sector unions. So here in Vermont, we want to say we're different, right? I like to say we're different. And so this was a concrete way, right in the shadow of that Supreme Court ruling, that our legislators could have showed and demonstrated that, no, we are different. We are Vermont. We stand with working people. And we didn't get a hearing. So that's a problem. We'd like to reapproach that last year. And we're not looking to have enemies. We're looking to have friends in the State House. And I don't care if they're from the Democratic Party, Progressive Party, or Republican Party. We want to have friends. And we want them to demonstrate that friendship by taking our priorities and making them their priorities. So we need to see that next year, or there will be repercussions politically.
How many public sector employees are not unionized at this point? Are there particular groups who might, you know, you'd be sort of targeting with this if it became possible?
Well, if you look at the towns, for example, my union, AFSCME, we represent, we have 45 contracts around the state. The majority of those are with towns and cities, you know, city of Burlington, towns of Hinesburg, the list goes on and on. But even so, do the math on that, where the IBW and the steelworkers represent a few towns too, but just a few. Really, most are that are organized are represented by AFSCME. So there's still another 200, 190 or something along these lines of towns that are not organized. So absolutely right there's folks that would be positively impacted by such a more fair process for them to form a union.
And just briefly, we have 3 minutes left in this segment, but, you know, talking about sort of how you rally people inside and outside the legislature to actually get some of this change you want. Obviously, you know, the previous leadership wasn't as effective as you would have liked, as others would have liked. I guess I'm wondering if you could talk about the sort of nuts and bolts of how you go about making this change.
Well, again, I have nothing but respect for the previous leadership. They share many of our values, and they worked as hard as they absolutely could. So nothing but respect. But what we are going to do and what we are going to do different is we've already begun the process of sitting down and having meetings with coalition partners, we're going to be meeting with folks from 350.org, for example. We had a presence. We were proud to have a presence at the climate strike the other day. And we're going to build a large coalition to help make the pressure from the bottom up for some of the values and the goals that we have, be it the Green New Deal, union-based Green New Deal, or be it card check or livable wage. Internally, we're going to engage much more of our rank and file and our members that are in every town, every community across the state of Vermont in one capacity or another, and we're going to have them part of the political process, and that's a game changer. I mean, our power isn't in a couple good lobbyists in Montpelier. Our power is in the blue and white collar workers who are in every community, who have family and have roots all across Vermont. So that's where our emphasis is going to be, and it's going to be for the long haul. And it won't be easy. And the kind of transformations we're talking about will take a lot of hard work and a lot of fight. But we're ready to do that, and we're looking forward to it.
You mentioned a good lobbyist in Montpelier, and some of the other unions in the state. The Vermont NEA and VSEA have very well-connected lobbyists and seem to get their priorities moving fairly fast. So I guess I'm wondering, do you think there's any value in sort of playing the establishment game of, having a good lobbyist who can sort of speak up for the AFL-CIO on the issues you care about?
I would rather hire an organizer than to hire a lobbyist. We're ultimately going to grow our power by organizing new shops, and that's something that the new executive board has already voted to do. We are taking the money that we traditionally pay to a lobbyist, and we are going to hire on-call organizers to help our affiliates organize new shops and internally organize around the state. So if I had to pick one or the other, I would pick organizing new workers into the union any day of the week over hiring a lobbyist. We will still have a presence in the State House. I'll be at the State House. Dennis LeBounty, our political director, will be at the State House. But our emphasis is building our power out, not paying somebody money with a tie on to try to advocate on our behalf.
And 45 seconds, you mentioned card check. What are the other priorities of the union heading into the next session?
Livable wage, of course. This is a high priority for us. It's only right that if you're working for a living, you should be able to pay the bills and make ends meet. Card check is a huge priority, like I said. We're also going to be starting the conversation about a statewide, town meeting referendum system that would take a constitutional change in Vermont.
Great. Well, Dave Van Dusen, thanks so much for joining us here on the Dave Graham Show.
We've got lots of
great stuff coming up for you in the next hour and a half. Stick around.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins Tone Code, fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Welcome back, listeners. I'm Colin Mine, the managing editor of vtdigger.org, filling in for Dave Graham on his appropriately named show this morning. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-802-244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. That's 1-877-291-TALK. If you missed the first half hour with Dave Van Dusen, the president of the AFL-CIO, talking about some of the changes he wants to make in that organization, you can go to the WDEV's website, wdevradio.com, where all of the previous episodes of the Dave Graham Show, as well as this one in a few hours, will be posted online. Our next guest is Emily McKenna of Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice, talking about some events that they've got planned, or one event in particular that they've got planned in the next few weeks. Good morning, Emily.
Actually, it's Kim Farnham. that's okay. I'm the Director of Community Relations and Development.
No problem. We're so happy to have you.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to be here, actually, to promote our 20th year anniversary of Seasons of Life. It's our fashion show, dinner, and live auction. It's our largest fundraising event. And it's scheduled for Friday, October 4th. And as of right now, we have about 25 tickets left to sell out completely.
Awesome. I have a press release here running down some of the stars of the show, et cetera. I saw there is a fellow media member who's going to keynote the event.
Yes, we are so excited. Tom Messner, chief meteorologist from NBC5, will be joining us. And he will also be conducting our live auction that evening as well.
And what kind of stuff is on the auction block?
We have 14 packages. Items ranging from one package actually is a beachfront home in Campana in Placencia, Belize. And we have a shopping spree package, a package which is Coffee with Tom Messner. And we have a dining out package. And all of these, of course, were donated by different individuals and businesses within our community.
And this is the 20th Seasons of Life fundraiser for Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice, I saw, yeah?
It is. Yep, it's our 20th year. In fact, this event, when it started 20 years ago, just to give you a little history on the event, it started as a luncheon, and it was a very small event with one modeling set, no live auction. Like I said, it was a luncheon. It was held at the Capitol Plaza even then. And as the years went on, the event grew and grew, and people, more and more people wanted to come. So we expanded the event into a more formal event in the evening that includes the live auction. And we also, this year, we have a special guest coming in to perform during the dinner. But I'm not going to say who that is.
Oh, the suspense.
Yes, the suspense.
And can you talk about sort of what the organization does more generally? You know, what sort of services you're providing across Central Vermont?
Yeah, we actually, I'll tie this into how we rebranded Seasons of Life. It was previously Colors of Autumn 5 years ago. So we rebranded the event to take into consideration, to reflect upon the array of services that we do offer here, and also the ages that we provide services to. We provide services to newborn babies all the way up to, you know, the elderly. We provide home health and hospice services. We've got a telehealth program here, maternal and child health program. We offer physical therapy, occupational therapy, social work. So we do offer a lot of services, and a lot of people use us as, you know, their primary care.
Really remarkable range of services, indeed. How do people, you know, if they're in need of, you know, any of those wide range of things, how do they sort of connect to Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice?
Certainly they can connect with us on our website. And that is www.cvhh.org, or they can call. Our number is 223-1878. And, you know, any of us are available to answer questions about the services here.
You mentioned telehealth is one of the things. I imagine that that's a fairly new addition to the services that you provide.
It is, yeah. We've been offering this service for a while. And, you know, telehealth is provides, you know, an extra layer of clinical support to some of our patients. Those patients, say, with COPD, chronic heart disease, diabetes. But we have a lot of our supporters actually participate in this program. We have grants that support it. It is not reimbursable by insurance. So a lot of our supporters out in the community actually contribute to this program. Mm-hmm. So it will continue to flourish and grow.
And the sort of, you know, I imagine it takes quite a bit of financial and sort of human resources support to make all this possible. How important is Seasons of Life to keeping things operating over there?
You know, Colin, it's very important, as is, you know, all of our development initiatives here. You know, we provide, part of our mission, of course, is to provide healthcare services to everyone in the 23 communities that we serve here in Central Vermont. And there are many folks out there that have little or no healthcare insurance whatsoever. And we provide, you know, care to everybody, regardless of their ability to pay. So Seasons of Life is very important We're expecting to raise over $50,000 this year, which will be used for, you know, all of our services that we offer here. And in addition to our telehealth program, clinical education, all of our fundraising dollars support those initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sounds like the organization really sort of, you know, fills in the cracks in the healthcare system. I suppose, you know, obviously the cost of healthcare and the inability of many people to pay for it has been, you know, is a feature of our political debate these days. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering, in Vermont, do you find that there's a greater need for this sort of support where otherwise people wouldn't be getting it?
You know, I think personally, I think it's important across the country in terms of philanthropic support. I think many healthcare organizations, especially those visiting nurse associations, are finding that, you know, philanthropic support is becoming more and more important. Mm-hmm. As we, you know, are challenged by healthcare reform.
And as far as that healthcare reform, I mean, do you do you have thoughts on sort of what sort of changes need to be made so that people are less reliant on philanthropy and that the healthcare system does a better job of taking care of people?
You know, I do have personal thoughts. I don't want to get too political here.
That's fine.
I would like to talk a little bit more about our event, if I could.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I know a lot of people are listening today, and one of the things that brings in a ton of people are, you know, those individuals that are embedded in our community and in our organization that get up there on the runway, and people are drawn to going to the show to see those individuals. So I just wanted to give a shout out to those individuals that are participating in the show this year, if I could.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got Sophie Rosignol and her sister, Julie Rosignol, Sharon Duby, Robin Cohen, Lacey Bennett, Sierra Pembroke, Hope Sharp, Nora Kennedy, the Downing family from Slope Style. We've got Ian, Mary Beth, and their daughter, Hadley, Gene Smith and Bill Patnow, Tracy DeLude, Shelby Lunn, Kevin Spaulding and his daughter, Emily Grace, Claire McAfee, Lindsay Haley, Audrey Molman, Sam Leibowitz, John Lennon, and Christine Laser, Heather Robital, Laura Weber, Cassidy Noyes, Zoe Longchamp, Caroline Murphy and her daughter, Grace, Mallory Minosh, Hannah Reed, Mia Moore, Patty Haynes, Sharon Morris, Sue Minter, Betsy Bishop, Jana Lee Willett, Michael Posebut, Crystal Peterson, and Kelly Murphy.
What a lineup.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's always interesting, you know, to hear the names of those that are in the show. I think that really entices people to attend.
Of course. I recognize a few of them myself, including some former gubernatorial candidates and head of the Chamber of Commerce and many, many others. What does it mean to be part of the show?
A lot of these people are either donors themselves or they're volunteers. You know, they will come to rehearsal the night before and they'll donate probably a couple hours of their time that evening. And everybody that's in the show is just really excited and looking forward to participating.
Does in the show mean some sort of performance or?
Yep, they will be getting up on the runway and modeling to various music. We have a DJ, Michael Douglas from Barrie, who will be doing the music for us this year. And he works with one of our committee members, Allison Jones, to make that all happen.
You just read off a impressive list of models, members of the community who are going to turn out to put on a show. Where do the clothes come from this? Where's the fashion inspiration?
You know, we deal with a lot of boutiques within central Vermont. And those that are right in downtown Montpelier that participate in the show are Bailey Road, Number 9 Boutique, Salam, Flash Naturals, Rome, Onion River Outdoors, Slope Style, Rebel Heart, Z Butano, and in East Montpelier, we have Shailene Bridle. In Barrie, we've got Wilkins Harley Davidson. In Stowe, we have Bunya, in Company, Green Envy, Yellow Turtle, Well Healed. In Warren, we have the Warren Store. And in Waterbury, we have Sunflower Boutique and Stowe Street Emporium. And then in Burlington, we have Jess Boutique.
That is impressive lists.
Yes.
A wide range of fashions, indeed.
Yes, and a lot of, and of course, all these stores support us, support what we do and the work that we do out in the Central Vermont community.
And if we go behind the scenes a bit, how do you decide, who does the styling for this? How do you match up this long list of models with the styles that will best suit them?
You know, we have a planning committee made up of 15 people in the community. And, we basically go through, depending on personality, their own personal style, whether they shop at the store or not, and we pair up and match up people with the stores that we think would best, fit their personality and their personal style. Because when they get up there on the runway, if they're feeling comfortable in the clothing that they're wearing, they're going to provide that much more entertainment to all the guests that are there.
Yeah. And if we can circle back, you spoke briefly, there's 25 tickets left for the show. And how do people go about getting those? And how much space is there generally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do have 25 tickets left. People can register online, Colin, at www.cvhh.org, or they can call me, Kim Farnham, at 224-2234, or they can contact Jean Seprabon at 224-2286. So there's two numbers they can contact, not to make it more confusing, but 224-2234 or 224-2286.
Great, and only 25 tickets left, so make the call quick or check out cvhh.org, which has lots of information both about this show and about the sort of services and physicians and providers and the leadership team over there at the organization and many, many other things at the website. It's cvhh.org. Do the people who, obviously you work with a lot of folks, older folks, you also talked about working with newborns, do the service receivers, I don't know how you refer to them, clients or patients, do they get involved in the show at all?
Yes, many of them actually do attend the show, and many of them are supporters of the organization as well.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And any models?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'd like to, if I just have a moment, I'd like to thank our top sponsors, if I could.
Sure thing.
Our event sponsor is Northfield Savings Bank. Our platinum sponsor this year is New England Excess Exchange. Our venue sponsor is Capital Plaza Hotel and Conference Room. Spotlight sponsors are Carmen Beck, Cody Chevrolet, John Gardner, Maple Capital Management, Community National Bank, and National Life Group.
Yeah, again, companies from all across the spectrum here in Central Vermont, for everything from models to the people providing the fashion to the sponsors. It's really a remarkable coalition of organizations and businesses that you guys have put together.
Yeah, it really is. We're very lucky to have the supporters that we do in our community.
And you mentioned that back in the beginning, 20 years ago, when this was called, you said Colors of Autumn as opposed to Seasons of Life, that it was a much smaller outfit, a luncheon. Can you just talk a bit about how things have grown and how the organization has made that happen?
Yeah, the event has grown. I mean, in the beginning, I believe there were maybe 50 people that attended this event, and now we have close to 250 people that attend this event. So it has grown. There has been demand in the community for more people wanting to attend and support the organization, which is great. We've had the event at the Capitol Plaza. It's also been held at National Life, and we're back at the Capitol Plaza now in the Governor's Ballroom. That's where the dinner and the show take place, and registration is in the Ethan Allen Room. So it's, you know, a beautiful location. They provide a very nice meal and dinner during the event. And, you know, like I said, with Tom Mester being our celebrity MC this year, it's going to be a really great show. We're really looking forward to it.
Yeah, fantastic. The website is cvhhh.org. 25 tickets left. Get yours before they're out. We're talking to Kim Farnham of Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. And how have the styles changed over the years there? And the sort of the number of fashion stores and businesses who have been part of this.
Yeah, the styles, the fashions have definitely changed over the years. And, of course, that's what keeps it interesting, too, and keeps people coming back year after year to see who's up on the runway and what the latest and greatest fashions are. It's always fun to see that as well.
And I'm wondering for folks who may not, can you explain sort of the geographical range that you guys provide services to? Is it particular counties or...
Yes, we provide services to 23 communities in central Vermont, most that are within Washington County and a few in Orange County.
And this is a bit outside of your purview, but for folks who are listening who may not be within that area, how can they find out where they might get home health and hospice services?
They certainly can contact us, and we would be happy to help them figure that out. Again, we're at 223-1878. And, you know, the other thing they can do is go to the VNA website, too, to see where all the different VNAs are located and their contact information within Vermont.
Great. Well, Kim, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about Seasons of Life this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks, Colin, for having us.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
So the second hour of the show here, we're going to talk about the climate strikes. We're going to have on a environmental or atmospheric scientist and organizers of Friday's climate strikes to talk about what's next. And we're going to talk to former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Christine Hallquist about an issue that she's been speaking out about recently, Free the Nipple campaign. So this is the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV Radio Vermont. Stick around for a great last hour.
Ah, sweet September. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Good morning, Vermont. I'm Colin Mine, filling in for Dave Graham Show, or filling in for Dave Graham here on The Dave Graham Show on WDEV Radio Vermont. This last hour, we're going to talk about the climate strikes on Friday, as well as the UN Climate Action Summit in New York, which begins today, and sort of how folks hope to turn the collective action that we saw across Vermont, across the country, and across the world into some sort of policy changes and into political action. There's a vast sort of variety of things that people are asking for, changes that they want to have made, and talking to scientists and activists about that. Our guests are going to be Abby Mnookin. She's a coordinator of 350 Vermont's Mother Up, Families Rise Up for Climate Action Project. And we're also going to talk to a atmospheric scientist at Northern Vermont University. They're going to be calling in a few minutes here. In the meantime, a brief rundown of what's online at vtdigger.org. That's the website. My day job is managing editor of VT Digger, filling in for Dave here. And we always have a star-studded lineup of stories coming at you on Monday mornings. You can find an article by yours truly that looks a bit deeper into a conversation that you may have heard here on the Dave Graham Show a couple weeks ago, talking to Mike Donahue, who's a very well-known and well-respected journalist here in Vermont. He was a longtime reporter, First Amendment reporter for the Burlington Free Press the last few years in retirement. He's been a rather prolific freelancer. And looking at his involvement in a Catholic Church review of priests' abuse and sort of some of the ethical issues that surround journalists getting involved in things that aren't necessarily journalistic in nature. Again, you can find that at vtdigger.org. For the next few minutes, we're going to talk to Bob Ney about what's going on down in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Colin. How are you?
Yeah, good. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
You too.
It's all Biden versus Trump down there this weekend.
Well, it sure is, and it's the Ukraine. Let's see, last election was Russia. Now this election's the Ukraine, you know?
That's right.
They're taking their turns. I think there's a couple important points to this story. Why don't we get to the political side, if we could, first?
Sure thing.
You know, there's people that are saying, well, how would the president feel involved, you know, somebody going after his son? Well, from the president's point of view, they are going after his kids, the U.S. House, you know, with an investigation. So that kind of wipes each other out. I'm not, you know, saying that that's any big deal. I think the largest deal on this is what happened with the whistleblower, and it was that suppressed, first of all. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Second of all, it depends on what the president actually said, our president, to the president of the Ukraine. If, in fact, he said, you know, you ought to investigate Joe Biden and his son, and, hey, you know, I'd like to help you on foreign aid, then there's a beyond a major problem. If, in fact, the president just raised the issue of Biden and his son, then it's not very tactful or tasteful, but I don't think it's impeachable just
sure.
for raising that issue. So, but stay tuned. Now, I did want to mention one other thing. It's kind of interesting. I do a podcast, and for 6 months, the co-host of that podcast has just been all over this Biden story, wanting to do podcast after podcast on it. So, you know, I was aware of it, but
what's the name of the podcast?
It's Bob Ney Door to Door. Yeah, Bob Ney Door to Door.
If we're going
to
do a plug, let's do it right here. So,
oh, thank you. Thank you, Colin. And I didn't go for it. You know, I said, well, fine, if you want to bring it up one time, which I think he did like probably 6 months ago. But I guess the reason I raised all of that is because, you know, beyond people who are kind of political followers knowing this whole scenario with Biden and his son was a potential, you know, issue, it wasn't out there. This kind of brings it out there, which doesn't hurt Trump, but most likely doesn't do Joe Biden a lot of good if it continues with the Democratic constituency.
Yeah, and I saw in the New York Times, you know, this morning, they had an explainer, sort of, Joe Biden and Russia, what you need to know, you know. So Trump has done a pretty remarkable job, as he often does, of taking one story and sort of turning it into another.
Into another. Correct.
So there's a whistleblower complaint out there somewhere. I guess the Attorney General has advised that it not be sent to Congress, and that the folks like Adam Schiff, the chair of House Intelligence, and Nancy Pelosi are very upset about this. And they're saying that this could sort of increase the prospects of impeachment proceedings. But is there a recording of this call that's in question? I mean, is that out there somewhere? Do we even know if that exists?
Well, most of these calls are recorded. I'm going to kind of step out on the limb and say that a lot of these calls are recorded. I guess the question is, and this always happens when you've got foreign leaders, you always hear our government has done it in, you know, the past three presidents. Well, in the interest of national security, we can't release that. I mean, that's what we always hear. And so you always wonder how much is in the interest of national security, or how much is that used as a shield? It's hard to say.
Yeah.
You
know? And when you hear, you know, Adam Schiff saying this could, this sort of non-committal but threatening language, this could be the sort of last straw towards impeachment. Nancy Pelosi saying this is unacceptable. To what extent do you still think that this sort of idea that House leadership is actually going to support impeachment hearings, do you take that seriously?
Well, Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker, had to say something because, you know, Adam Schiff was sort of in agreement with her of not doing impeachment, whereas Chairman Jerry Nadler of Judiciary was, you know, full steam ahead. And I think Nancy Pelosi had to say something because Adam Schiff is starting to change, you know, his thoughts on it. Of course, there's a caveat. It depends on what the president said. I do believe, though, if the president just raised the issue again, I don't think it's impeachable. If he cut some kind of deal with the president of Ukraine, that's a different world. Now, here's the other problem with impeachment, period. This is going to be October. 2020, January, is full-blown election, right? And if the Democratic side is going to impeach, I mean, the clock's running out because in an election year, this would just suck the political air out of the entire political system, and we would be nothing but impeachment. I mean, the Democratic presidential candidates would kind of be, you know, in the background.
Yeah, and I mean, it's certainly hard to see how this is going to help Joe Biden. It may or may not end up hurting Donald Trump in the end, but if nothing else, it's, shed quite a bit of light on Hunter Biden, his son's sort of role in this shady Ukrainian company, and it's hard to see how Joe Biden comes out better for this.
Well, he doesn't. I think, you know, again, everything from my co-host who's been, like I said, harping about this for months, I hear the whole thing, and he researched it. He's an attorney. He's looked at it. And he, by the way, he's a Republican, so he's not, he doesn't actually care for President Trump too much. But he just was pointing out about, you know, a couple of facts. If you're vice president of the United States, you do have to watch. If your son has a company that deals with another country, then you have to watch what you do. And I think probably the people that will yell most about this are going to be Biden's opponents, not the White House.
Yeah, and I heard one of Trump's surrogates, I can't recall which one it was, whether it was Mike Pompeo or, oh no, I believe it was Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, saying that, you know, he thought there was something wrong about a vice president's son doing sort of business around the world. And the question was turned on him pretty quickly and said, you know, Trump's children are, you know, they're cutting deals all around the world. Ivanka's getting copyrights here and there. So height of hypocrisy.
Well, it is. And then I was talking to a Democratic consultant because I posed a question to them. I do this a lot just to keep pace with beyond the news of what we really should be looking at. And the question I said is, why are you all so worried about Joe Biden and any scandals when you have, frankly, Donald Trump, you know, and you can match sort of scandal by scandal, right, between the two? And their answer was interesting. They said in a presidential campaign, do we want to go into it equal to the amount of problems that Trump has, or we want to go above? It's kind of interesting, which opens up a pathway for either Warren, you know, or Sanders, you know, something like that. Unless the Democratic Party wants to get very, very bold and take Buttigieg and somebody else as a running mate, you know, you never know.
Yeah. And as always, Bob, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you to speculate on something that you can't. Who do you think is going to be the Democratic candidate for president? And well, give me the full ticket this time, president, vice president.
Yeah, I used to go with Biden. I've got a feeling I'm going to go out here and say right now, if I were have to pick, I would say Warren Buttigieg.
Wow. All right.
That's a bold one, but Warren Buttigieg.
Yeah, the folks around here, I saw Warren Beto.
I would hope not for the benefit of the Democratic Party. Sorry, I'm going to make somebody angry with that, but I think Buttigieg would be far better a running mate than Beto.
Great. Well, Bob, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Always appreciate hearing your take on what's going on down there.
Thank you.
On the line right now are Janelle Hanrahan, an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at Northern Vermont University, and Abby Mnuchin, coordinator of 350 Vermont's Mother Up, Families Rise Up for Climate Action Project. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So on Friday, thousands and thousands of students, young and old, as well as people turning out to support the students, organizers, folks who, you know, have been advocating for climate action for quite some time, turned out across the state. Janelle, I imagine you were up at the strike at Northern Vermont University, and Abby down in Brattleboro, both places, hundreds of people turned out. Maybe you guys could just tell us a bit about Friday's strikes. Abby, how did things go down in Brattleboro?
Yeah, Brattleboro had an incredible turnout. We actually had 1,000 people on the streets here and shut down the streets in the middle of the day. We had hundreds of students coming both from Brattleboro schools, walking from the middle school and the high school and local elementary schools. And then we also had some students busing in from Bellows Falls and Putney and Marlboro. So I'd say more than half of those 1,000 people on the streets were youth, which was really exciting. But we also had people of all ages, workers on strike, workers on their lunch hour, some supported by their businesses and others not. But a really incredible showing of solidarity and coming out to encourage people to take action on climate and to tell our local and state legislators and elected officials that we need action now.
And officials down there were helpful as far as closing down streets and sort of making it possible for you guys to march?
Yeah, we had really great communication and cooperation with all levels of town offices, and the police department was very generous and closed down the streets for us and helped helped support making sure that everybody was safe out there.
And Janelle, what was the scene like in Linden?
So we didn't have over 1,000, but we did have a couple hundred. We had students, faculty, and staff, both from our atmospheric sciences department, but also from departments across the campus. We had some local residents who came out, all ages. We had students who came in from Riverside School, students who joined us on the street from Thaddeus Stevens, a few from Linden Institute. And so we had a wide range of ages, and it was a pretty exciting event because two of my students here in the Atmospheric Sciences Department were the coordinators of this event. Oftentimes we don't have such events over here in our corner of the state, and so it was nice to see something that was hyper-local here in Lindenville.
Yeah, a really remarkable day of action. Where I am in Montpelier, there was a brief die-in on the main streets where students lay down in the streets and had other students outline them in chalk and that sort of thing. I know the day's biggest event was in Burlington, where three separate marches met in front of City Hall and 2,000 to 3,000 people turned out. So, you know, I think folks who have been around a bit longer than me said it was probably the largest day of action they've seen since the Women's March a couple years ago.
Yeah, and I would echo that here as well, the largest action in Brattleboro, and also echo that the youth speakers were incredible, and we had almost entirely youth speakers up at the Common, about between 10 and 12 of them that spoke to the crowd, and hopefully they will all be published in this week's Voices section of the Commons if people want to take a look.
And both Janelle and Abby, I know you guys both do a lot of work on this issue on days where everyone's not, you know, striking for it and paying attention to it. And I wanted to talk to you both a bit about the separate things that you're doing there and sort of how you hope that the work that you're doing both at Northern Vermont University and with 350 Vermont can sort of continue and help everyone grapple with the coming changes. Abby, maybe you can start. You know, I know you spent some time at the State House this past session sort of advocating for things. Folks who do advocate for serious sort of action to address climate change were very disappointed with what happened in the last session, or I should say what didn't happen in the last session. And I'm wondering how you sort of take this sort of, you know, big public action and turn it into political action.
Yeah, that's a great question, and that is the work that we have cut out for us moving forward. But political leaders act when the people make it impossible not to, and that's feeling more and more the case. So we plan to continue to put a lot of pressure on our elected officials to take action. Echoing what you said, last session was extremely disappointing. And we really hope that actions like Friday's climate strike are sending these messages really loud and clear to both our allies and those who may not yet consider themselves allies, but just that this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue that affects everyone, and it often affects people who have contributed the least get affected the most, and that includes our youth who came out in droves on Friday. So we're going to be pushing a ban on fossil fuel infrastructure as we did last year. We really need to also completely overhaul our transportation system, which accounts for 45% of emissions here in Vermont. We really need to invest in local renewable energy sources. We have to also increase weatherization efforts and make that accessible to all Vermonters. And there's also something called the Global Warming Solutions Act that other New England states have enacted that we want to see Vermont do the same. So we hope that Friday will just be one of many, many moments where the legislature feels the pressure from people to act.
Yeah. If you'd like to join the conversation about Friday's climate strikes and climate action more generally, you can call in at 1-802-244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. That's 1-877-291-TALK. We're on the line here with Janelle Hanrahan, an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at Northern Vermont University, and Abby Mnookin, coordinator of 350 Vermont's Mother Up Climate Action Project. Abby, if we could just continue briefly, you talked about sort of some of the priorities as far as what types of laws you'd like to see passed, the fossil fuel infrastructure ban, this Global Climate Solutions Act. I may have what is it called again?
Mm-hmm. A Global Warming Solutions Act.
Sure, sorry. And that would sort of hold state agencies to account for the goals and sort of policies that are actually in place and mm-hmm. eventually allow citizens to actually take some sort of legal action if the government is not taking its commitment seriously. Do you think that there are things that you and others pushing for these policies can do differently from the last session? I mean, I was in the State House on some of the days where you and other folks were rallying there. There's a climate caucus, which is like-minded House members and senators sort of trying to strategize. And I guess I'm wondering, do you think that a different approach is needed? Do you think a louder approach is needed? Sort of how are you going to adapt after the frustration of the last session?
Yeah, that's a good question. Definitely regrouping and thinking more about it. Also, at 350, we take many different approaches to change making, and one of the models that we use is called the 4 R's, where we look at ways, all the different types of changes that are needed in order to enact system change, which is something that we really believe is needed to address the climate crisis in any meaningful way. So those 4 R's stand for reform, resist, reimagine, and recreate. And all 4 of those, like I said, are really necessary in order to bring about system change. So legislative policy and, you know, putting pressure on legislators to take action falls under the reform mm-hmm. R, which we believe is really important, but it's not exclusively what we're focusing on. So there are agencies and organizations and individuals who really focus on that exclusively, and each of the R's we feel like is really necessary. So we have other branches that are focusing on the other R's as well. So we definitely are going to put pressure on and hopefully increase the pressure, and we'll be returning in February for our Mother Up Day at the State House. Last year we went on Valentine's Day and delivered 180 love letters to the planet, to each of the legislators at the State House. And so we will be doing that again, returning this year close to Valentine's Day. And I think more pressure is needed, no doubt. But I also think that other ways of making change are also needed. So resist, reimagine, recreate, all of those play a part in bringing about the changes that we need to see.
Yeah. I should note that the UN Climate Action Summit began today, so Vermont was obviously part of a worldwide movement to sort of apply this sort of pressure to global leaders, and obviously a lot of people think that, you know, global change is really what needs to happen here. We have a caller on the line. Joe from Bristol, do you have a question for our guest today?
day. How was everyone?
Oh, we're good.
Well, thank you.
Fine. No, I just need someone to explain how the, to me, because I'm, I have an opinion, but how the carbon dioxide molecule, after it enters into the upper atmosphere, keeps creating heat.
I'm going to leave that one to Janelle.
Yeah, I'm happy to tackle that one. So in my climatology and thermodynamics classes, I oftentimes use the analogy of putting a blanket on your bed at night. So carbon dioxide in itself doesn't actually create heat, but what it does is it helps our planet be more efficient, or our atmosphere more specifically, be more efficient at kind of trapping radiation close to the surface of the Earth. So if we have the same amount of energy that's coming in at the top of our atmosphere, which is coming in from the sun in the form of shortwave radiation, that essentially passes right through greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide of which is a very strong one.
Can I interrupt you?
Let her finish.
So then that's absorbed then by the surface of the Earth, which then in turn emits long-wave radiation. And the long-wave radiation is what tends to interact with these greenhouse gases. So when we add additional greenhouse gases to our atmosphere, this is kind of like putting a thicker blanket on your bed at night. So it helps to keep you warmer, even though the heating source in your house hasn't changed.
Now, so you're saying there's a covalence bonding of carbon dioxide molecules?
So I'm not a chemist, so I'm not going to start talking about the details of the chemistry.
Well,
Joe, we've got 15 seconds if you want to finish up here.
Yeah. There is no proof of that carbon dioxide molecules have a bonding effect and cause have a blanket effect and recreate heat.
Joe, I'm afraid you're arguing against your own argument. Thanks for calling in, though. We're going to continue our conversation about the climate strike and about what's happening in academia and broader society in order to prepare everyone and in order to change what's happening. So stick around on the Dave Graham Show.
Ah, sweet September, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Welcome back to the Dave Graham Show. I'm Colin Mine, managing editor of ET Digger, filling in for Dave this morning. We're talking about climate action with Janelle Hanrahan, associate professor of atmospheric sciences at Northern Vermont University, and Abby Manukin, coordinator of 350 Vermont's Mother Up, Families Rise Up for Climate Action project. Janelle, I understand that Northern Vermont University is doing some interesting things around climate science and sort of how you're training people for professions dealing with some of this stuff. I was wondering if you could tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had an atmospheric sciences program around for about 45 years, and we train students who go on to do all sorts of things, ranging from being on the air as a broadcast meteorologist to going to graduate school to working in private industry. And we have a climate change concentration, which we've had for about a decade. And this concentration really allows our students to learn about the theory, to learn about climate modeling, so that they can go on to become climate scientists if that's something they're interested in doing. So it prepares them well to go on to get a master's and possibly a PhD in the field to contribute to the science. We do also now have a climate change science degree. So this is its own bachelor's degree, and this was started a couple of years ago. And this degree is designed to help students essentially serve as a liaison between climate scientists and the general public and business leaders and economists, and essentially understand what's happening to our climate system, what we need to do to adapt, what the projections mean, and then be able to effectively communicate that information to kind of the people with the boots on the ground and the people who really are the ones that can make a difference. Because up until recently, we've had a pretty big gap between, I guess, climate experts and the general public about what is happening in the field of the science. And so what happens is that conversations on the street and in politics are very, very different than conversations that are happening, say, at a conference, at a scientific conference. And so our goal with this new degree is to train students to be able to better communicate some of this information to the people who can actually do something with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting because we hear, you know, that, you know, 99% of scientists agree and this sort of thing, but, you know, maybe not hearing enough from the scientists themselves. You know, we had a caller before the break who obviously has his own doubts about what's happening with climate change, and he's not alone. No doubt the response to a series that VT Digger did last week, you know, we really got into the nitty gritty of how climate change is impacting Vermont and the commenters, lots of skeptics in there. And I guess I'm wondering, Janelle, sort of how much do you attribute that, or maybe I should ask, how do you train people to sort of to fill that knowledge gap, and how much of it do you really attribute to a lack of knowledge, or how much of it is sort of a political effort to undermine the science?
Yeah, I think a lot of it just comes down to just pure confusion. There's so much noise out there that the message from climate experts just isn't really getting out there. Because if you do a search online for information about climate change, you can find a lot, and a lot of it is really good stuff coming out from NOAA and NASA. But there's also a lot of misinformation. And so I think people just in general are confused. And so what we're doing with our students is not only are we providing them opportunities to engage with the public, we're trying to serve as examples, showing them that even though you're a scientist, you can still engage with the public, which is not something that's really been done that much in the past, and it certainly hasn't been rewarded professionally. And so we're just trying to get them to understand that, hey, it's okay to be doing it, because right now we really feel like it's a better way for people in the public to hear us as opposed to talking at conferences and writing in the peer-reviewed journals, which is the way that science has traditionally been communicated.
Yeah, and I guess you talked about sort of the hesitance to have that happen. And why is it that scientists sort of often shy away from being sort of public figures or advocating for what they know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of it has to do with the type of people that we tend to be. So scientists tend to be introverts. We tend to kind of buckle down and focus on the science and sit in front of a computer. And we tend to, you know, talk to each other, but mostly at conferences. And I think that the conversation that you're having with the general public is very different than one that you have in the classroom or at a conference. So at a conference, we've moved far past this idea of, for example, carbon dioxide being a very strong greenhouse gas, and this idea of humans changing our climate system. It's similar to gravity, where we just don't talk about it anymore. We've moved beyond that, and now we're trying to sort out some of the intricacies. And what happens is when you give, say, a public lecture or you're engaging with the public in another way, you end up finding yourself defending fundamental laws of thermodynamics. And it's just not something that you can, I guess, talk about in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, courses like climatology, it's a full two semesters, and atmospheric thermodynamics is a full semester. And so it's really hard to break down these ideas in short exchanges that you have with the public.
Sure. And Abby, you're obviously working on many of the same things in a different way. You know, we spoke about 350 Vermont obviously had a central role in organizing the strikes on Friday. Can you talk a bit about sort of what else you guys have planned?
Yeah, so like I said, kind of fitting in with our 4 R's framework, we are also working on kind of the recreate side of things and going to be launching a campaign that has to do with regenerative agriculture and storing carbon in our soils. And there's also an ongoing campaign that is focused on the current Vermont gas pipeline and making sure that pipeline is not expanded, and doing what we can to ban all fossil fuel infrastructure in Vermont so that we don't need to keep doing this case by case, and that it can just be throughout the state ongoing. So those are some of our bigger efforts. And then we also have local initiatives and groups throughout the state that meet locally that are working on things like here in Brattleboro. We just put some pressure on the select board from the local community to approve a full-time sustainability coordinator. And so efforts like that are also important so that change is happening at every level. So, you know, we need change individually, but more important than that, collectively, locally, regionally, on a statewide, on a national level, on a global level, because like I said, system change is what's needed here. So it takes it at every level to make that happen.
And I imagine on town meeting day coming up in not too long, you guys will have some other towns joining the dozens who have already sort of committed to climate action.
Yeah, exactly. We've 2 years ago we launched a town meeting day resolution campaign to throughout the state, and we have nearly 50 or just over 50 towns that have signed on to that, and more each year. So we expect more will be exactly voting that in, and that puts pressure then on local select boards and town officials to take action. And the more towns that do that, then the more pressure we can put on legislators in the State House to say, look at all these towns that have voted for this. We need to act.
Great. Well, you can find out more about what 350 Vermont's doing on their website, 350vermont.org. You can also get involved or donate to that organization. And if you want to find out more about what Northern Vermont University is doing to prepare the next generation of scientists for climate change, you can check out northernvermont.edu. Janelle and Abby, I want to thank you both so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the show, and thank you, Abby, for all the great work that you're doing.
Yeah, great to hear from you, and thanks for inviting me on, and I hope you continue to cover the climate movement.
We will, and I should put in a plug for vtdigger.org. Our environment reporter, Elizabeth Gripkoff, did a fantastic series with Covering Climate Now, a global journalism initiative looking at all kinds of interesting stuff relating to climate change in Vermont. Check it out at vtdigger.org. And we're going to make a hard shift here to a completely different topic, but equally interesting. We're going to talk to Christine Hallquist, former Democratic gubernatorial candidate, as well as a longtime energy executive, about an issue that she has been speaking out about recently. I caught on to it in an article on Valley News. It is the Free the Nipple campaign. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thanks so much for coming on.
Happy to be here.
I understand you just had a trip down to Birmingham. I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah, it was wonderful. I was very impressed. You know, Birmingham, you know, Alabama, you know, you typically think of as being kind of backwards in terms of the rights of civil rights and LGBT community, but Birmingham is an oasis, and of course, that's where the civil rights battles really were held during the 60s.
Yeah. So maybe we can start with this story, and just I can sort of have you do my part of the job, which is explaining what the case is exactly and that kind of thing, and then talk to you a bit about your involvement in it. But I understand this stems from a protest in New Hampshire a couple of years ago that's since turned into some legal troubles. Is that right?
Yes. It was a protest by three women who basically went topless to make a statement, and the statement was being made about the unfairness of our gender-specific laws. So when it comes to a law where women have to wear have their tops clothed and men don't, you know, there's a lot underneath that. You know, it, on the surface, you know, it may not seem like it's important, but when you look at gender-specific laws throughout the nation, they continue to reinforce traditional unhealthy gender stereotypes.
And this protest, and it violated some local ordinance, is that right?
Yes, it was Laconia, New Hampshire. It violated a local town ordinance requiring women to be fully clothed.
And that's since become, that sort of incident has become the center of this legal dispute.
Yes. I was contacted a couple months ago by an attorney from California because I was involved, after the campaign, I got involved with the Grab Them by the Ballot initiative, really to talk, you know, that was a response to the Me Too movement. And some of the things that, of course, I learned as a result of my gender transition, you know, I became hyper aware of, you know, the gender laws, gender discrimination, and the subtleties that occur in their everyday work life.
Mm-hmm. And this case is currently before you've joined a filing essentially in support of these women, and that's a joint brief. The U.S. Supreme Court has taken up the issue.
Well, yeah, it's looking at the issue. You know, it hasn't said that it's taken up the case yet, but the fact that they're looking at the issue indicates interest.
And this is part of the Free the Nipple campaign, which is, you know, as you talked about, sort of the issue that's at the center of this, the protests that was taking place of these three women was part of that. But is this a global sort of campaign to change the norms around laws relating to toplessness in public?
Yes, it's a global campaign to really eliminate gender-specific laws similar to, you know, the issues that grabbed them by the ballot, the Me Too movement. It's all tied together in the terms of truly creating gender equality.
Yeah. And in your filing or in this article on Valley News, which again is where they wrote an article about Christine's position on this, that's vnews.com, another great news website. But they said that, you know, you also talked about the sort of, you know, the law itself is sort of binary in nature and that's an issue for you as well.
Yeah, you know, I think it gets down to the point that, you know, in my transition from male to female, I really discovered the subtleties of gender. And, you know, I think first and foremost that these laws reinforce that a man doesn't control their sex drive. It's the woman's problem that a man gets aroused and causes harm. You know, it ties to the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. It ties rape and other issues. But specifically what I spoke about was about the fluidity of gender. That's what I was asked to speak about. It's the idea that these laws are becoming even more difficult to enforce as we begin to realize that gender is fluid with some people. So you may have transitioned to being a woman and your driver's license says you're male, and you can expose your breasts or vice versa. A woman whose driver's license says they're male and she still has breasts, you know, that are fully formed. Now it gets in this question around now we got to get down to the nuances of size and other things like that. And it really gets to the point where it shows, you know, just how difficult these laws are. Not only from the standpoint, you know, my position is we don't want to continue to reinforce bad gender stereotypes. Well, they're just not enforceable as well.
Yeah. If you want to join this conversation here with Christine Hallquist about the Free the Nipple campaign, you can call in at 1-802-244-1777 or toll free 1-877-291-8255. That's 1-877-291-TALK. And Christine, you know, if you sort of take if you wipe these laws off the book saying that you can't be topless in public, you know, then it becomes legal not only at beaches, but I imagine anywhere that a woman can go topless. And, you know, without sort of moralizing on it, that's a very different sort of social norm. And I guess I'm wondering for folks who say, you know, we're okay with this in a limited way, but not necessarily, you know, having women going topless around town, among children and that kind of thing. I mean, it seems like those are the kind of concerns in a sort of PR way that would have to be confronted as part of this campaign.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can certainly create local ordinances that require people to be fully clothed. You know, if a woman has to be clothed in an ordinance, you know, it should apply to the men too. I've seen some men that look pretty bad with their tops off, so I don't think it's that complicated. You know, it really is a matter of gender fairness. You know, on the surface, you could say, we don't want women running around topless. Well, you know, Vermont, it's illegal to go around naked in Vermont. We don't have people running around naked in Vermont. You know, people still have social norms, but it's just a matter of, you know, tearing down these laws that continue to reinforce that it's a woman's problem, that, you know, that men get it, you know, can't control themselves. It's the whole, you know, it ties to the whole rape culture, all the issues we've been facing that the Me Too movement has addressed.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily free all nipples, but either free nipples or lock them up. But you can't have different standards for different people.
Yes, yeah, that's the issue.
Great. Well, I invited you on to talk about this issue specifically, but I'm wondering if I can ask you a few questions about your post-candidate life here.
Sure.
So you said that you were down in Birmingham speaking. What was that speech about?
That was about climate change. I've actually formed a company in Canada. Our mission is to solve climate change. We're working with a couple of joint ventures to build a better battery, which batteries are critical. I wrote a paper called The North American Solution to Climate Change, because one of the things that happened on the campaign that I was disappointed about was that, you know, I talked to thousands of Vermonters, and only about 1 in 20 Vermonter had climate change as a top issue, which is, you know, I noticed your last caller was talking about 350 VT. I joined the 350 VT board because we've got to do a lot more education on the upcoming climate apocalypse. And then the other part is we can solve the problem. So those people that we did engage in conversation on climate change, they didn't believe the problem can be resolved. But of course it can be resolved. We created the problem. So, I've committed to my last dying breath to fight the ravages of carbon dioxide that threaten the entire planet.
And you talked about starting a company that's looking at building better batteries.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit more about that company?
Yeah, it's really a subset of the entire mission. The mission is to solve climate change. We're also working with liquid fuels and taking a careful look at biofuels as well as hydrogen storage. It really is to carry out, our company is to carry out the mission of the North American Solution to Climate Change. The North American Solution to Climate Change involves building a high-voltage DC transmission grid that connects all of North America, and that we start using our 155 gigawatts of hydropower as a backup resource, where today it's used as a baseload resource. Build as much solar and wind as possible, and then buffer it all with batteries. For example, wind. The interesting thing about wind is, you know, we put, you know, I led the project to put those wind turbines up on a low mountain. Those same wind turbines out in the Midwest would produce twice as much energy on an annual basis. Mm. So there's much more efficient places to do renewables, and it's a global issue. So I challenge people on this idea of energy interdependence and talk about energy codependence.
Cool. We have a caller on the line, Doug from Plainfield. Do you have a question for Christine?
Yeah, I actually have a question. Is anybody boycotting or picketing NASA? Because how much damage do they do to our atmosphere?
Well, I'm not even aware of how much damage NASA does. I imagine because they're not launching that many rockets that they're probably number 1,000 or 1,500 on the list of carbon emitters.
They use just as much fuel to get up into space as I don't know how many cars in the day.
We think about it, but they're not like the 12,000 planes that are flying every day. You know, they're launching them every once in a while. So I'm guessing, you know, and again, I'm guessing because I haven't done the research, that their carbon dioxide contribution to the planet is very low in terms of the priority.
Yeah, it seems like that really cars are where a lot of the game's at. I mean, you talked about, obviously, electricity power, that sort of thing as well. And how about cars, especially in a place like Vermont that, people like to drive? There's not any really public options. How do we sort of confront that aspect of things?
Well, that's why the batteries are so important. You know, today's, if you look at the batteries we're evaluating right now and looking at commercializing, you know, they'll provide about three times the distance of today. You know, so if you look at cars with 230 to 250 miles on a charge, it's still difficult for Vermonters who want to get around. But if you can go 700 miles on a charge and you can charge it in 15 or 20 minutes, that's the kind of thing that will cause the breakthrough. And we're right on the precipice of those kind of breakthroughs.
We were talking to, you know, 350 Vermont, Abby Mnuchin, who was involved in some of the state house advocating they did. You obviously ran with some ambitious climate policies during your run for governor. And during the last session, you know, there was a lot of disappointment about sort of, you know, there was a Democratic supermajority or super coalition in the House. And, you know, most of the steps that were taken were pretty incremental. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why it seems so hard for politicians in Vermont to really make some of these ambitious changes that people think need to be made in order to protect our future.
Well, I think it is, you know, I'm certainly not going to blame it on the legislature because they represent Vermonters. I don't think Vermonters have become serious enough about this issue. You know, as again, I said before, you know, I talked to thousands of Vermonters. It wasn't on their top list. So, you know, we have a lot more education to do. You know, those of us who have been studying this, you know, I went to the, under Governor Douglas, took a group of us up to Canada in 2005 to listen to the first Intergovernmental Climate Change Commission report. And things are about three times as bad. You know, so those of us that have been studying this science, we know we're in big, big trouble. You know, I just sent out a tweet this morning that says, you know, we'll see likely a 5% decline in gross domestic product by 2050 and possibly 20% by 2100. You know, this threatens the entire global economy as well as the U.S. economy. So our entire future is highly threatened, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of climate refugees by 2050. You know, so even the way we're approaching this issue as a country, you know, the idea that we can build walls and protect ourselves, that's going to get us all killed. You know, what we really need to do is learn how to collaborate with people across the world that we may not like, because we're going to have to work together to solve this problem.
Yeah. And just briefly shifting to another issue that you really highlighted in your campaign, which is broadband across the state. There was an effort in the legislature. They ended up approving something between $1 and $2 million to sort of empower local, you know, towns and cities to start their own broadband buildouts. I guess I'm wondering, what did you think about that step, and how seriously do you think people are taking that issue?
I don't think they're taking that seriously enough. I think that's a drop in the bucket. You know, the thing I was pushing was having electric utilities take responsibility for the telecommunication infrastructure. If you do that, you can cut the costs in half. No matter how we do it, with the current way we handle telecommunications, we're not going to get to the rural parts of Vermont. And it ties to, you know, I get frustrated every time I listen to the talk about Vermont's declining population. Yeah, you can't do business here. You know, I'm at home today, and you know, trying to do business on the DSL lines is extremely difficult. So it's, you know, we're just not going to grow our business in Vermont without being connected. And I certainly applaud the legislature for doing everything they can, but it really is, you know, again, it takes bold leadership. And you know, I'm of course, you know, I ran for office, but that's, you know, Vermonters made their decision, but we do need bold leadership on this issue.
Yeah, speaking of that, can we expect you to throw your hat in the ring for any statewide races here in the coming years?
I would say not in the near future, but you know, certainly, you know, I'll watch. You know, it really, really boils down to if Donald Trump doesn't get reelected, then I'll throw my hat in the ring and try to help rebuild America. If he does get reelected, then we may be a lost cause.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Christine, for taking the time to talk this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you all out there for listening to the Dave Graham Show today. It's always my pleasure and privilege to fill in here on WDEV Radio Vermont in its Waterbury studio. To all you folks out there, I hope you have a wonderful day. And enjoy this last breath of summer and first breath of fall.